Take 55 onto House Committee on Judiciary, April 30th, 1979, 1:30 p.m. Full Committee, Room 350. Public hearing and work session on HB 2284, HB 2560, HB 2800, HB 2894,
Senate Bill 216. House Committee on the Judiciary will come to order. Clerk will note those members present. The ballots are excused. First item on the agenda is possible introduction of committee bills. Dennis?
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we've got a bill here that is going to Representative Winquist. Representative Kitzhaber?
He just went back to committee, and Dr. Cherry, too.
Okay, well, I understood that you were all on the same bill. Am I wrong?
Yes, we're all on the same bill.
Okay, it has to do with liability of EMTs.
Liability of what?
Emergency medical technicians. It's comparable in some ways to the bill that you already passed out of committee for at the request of Representative Simpson, but it differs in some respects too.
And I don't get one, I won't vote for it.
And Representative Linquist can address the differences.
Okay. Mr. Blinkless, can you just say a couple of words?
Well, basically, Mr. Chairman, the bill that you put out for Representative Simpson was a bill that I introduced originally to take care of this problem. His problem was a little bit different, and he was adding to the Good Samaritan Law language for voluntary EMTs. There's a whole community of EMT 2s, 3s, and 4s who are not necessarily voluntary that we're trying to cover. We're trying to also cover the situation where the EMT is calling by radio communication or telephone communication back to the emergency room, and where the doctor in the emergency room is using the eyes and ears of that person out in the scene to tell him what the situation is, and we're trying to cover the person under that circumstance only. And that's what the essence of this bill is.
Yeah. I'd say for the for the benefit of the members of the committee that at the time that the other bill came up, there was quite a bit of discussion between Representative Simpson, Linquist, and myself as to what form that bill would take, and as to whether or not there should be two vehicles for discussing what were, at least in the minds of Representative Simpson, two distinct policy issues. And I promised at that time that I would support and urge the committee to support introduction of a committee bill so it could raise that issue. The chair would move introduction of the bill as outlined by Representative Linquist as a committee bill. Is there discussion?
Yeah, can I ask a question, Mr. Chairman? I won't delay this longer, Mr. Chairman. Both the MDs in our august group were here. They both agreed.
Yes, in fact,
Mark said he just put it here to co-sponsor with your main request jointly.
Yes, at the request of the three of us, would be fine, or however you want to do it.
In other words, would it be safe to say, and I don't want to get into the subject of the bill, that in essence you feel that the responsibility lies with the MD back in the hospital, and if he wants to prescribe using somebody else's eyes and ears, it's his risk?
Well, any time that he's in the hospital, in an emergency room, he's covered by the liability of the hospital. But in this particular circumstance, we'd like to have him covered under this tort liability along with the EMT 2, 3, or 4.
Does this do this?
Yes.
In other words, it covers the physician?
The physician that's communicating with him, only to what he's communicating in at that time. That's all we're trying to cover the doctor for. We're not trying to cover him any other time. He's under his own liability law.
Representative Roman?
Yeah, Ed, is it your view that this would change the existing law, or is it your view that this would simply clarify the rule that you trust would prevail anyway?
It further clarifies the rule, yes. It doesn't prevent someone from being sued. It just simply says that the legislature has recognized this area, and if the person is acting as a prudent man and with the training he has, that he should be covered then. And there's always, of course, they can be sued and said that they did what was not prudent, as you well know. But it just simply makes it a little tougher for, in a trial situation to sue that person. It doesn't prevent it.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the motion, on the chair, the motion of the chair, Representative Richards?
Mr. Chairman, as long as there are a number of students here this morning, I wonder if we might just give them a one-sentence description about the bill we're discussing.
Okay, this is a bill that deals with tort immunity, which regulates the rules by which a person can or cannot be sued civilly in a court of law, and it relates to emergency medical care by certain people.
If you watch Gage on TV,
yeah, this is going to help him out.
Cover him from being sued. What do you think? How's that?
Yeah, that's good. Is there further discussion?
My little daughter's in love with him.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, it's so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. First item on the agenda is public hearing on House Bill 2280.
What about just cleaning up, get the vote? Larry has to check every time.
He's going to wait. He's going to wait.
Okay, then here's your bill to sign.
Okay. Didn't they add a...
First bill up for public hearing is House Bill 2284. Mr. Van Adam.
I am Fred Van Adda, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association. There are perhaps two ways to attack the problem. One is to discuss what the need is, and then I think I'll discuss first what the need is, cite an example, and then take you very quickly through the bill. I'm distributing two letters to you that would fall in the category, I guess, of horror stories. One of them from, I'll just touch two or three points on, from Harrison Holmes in Eugene, who attempted to develop a mobile home park in the area. Because of the nature of the Eugene ordinance, it was necessary for him to spend $10,000 to $20,000 designing the park in the initial approval stage. It was approved by the hearing officer, and on the final day before the hearing officer order became effective, a citizens group filed an appeal to the Planning Commission. After the Planning Commission approved it, on the last day of appeal, four members of the group filed for a writ of review in the circuit court, posting the $1,000 bond. I think that was prior to the effective date. This occurred in 1974, prior to the effective date of the present legislation that's being amended by the bill before you. To that point, because he had to proceed, his attorneys and architectural fees exceeded $75,000, according to the letter that he has before you. I'm sure that all of you that are in the practice of law have at one time or another come across similar sorts of cases. You can read the details of the additional details of the horror story yourself, but the point of the legislation is to reduce frivolous litigation. Turning to the bill, this, if you will, expands on a piece of legislation that was adopted in the 1977 session, which incorporated the $1,000 bond on a writ of review. Going down the language of the bill on line 12 and 13, you'll see we're proposing to delete the provision that the bond only lies when you seek a stay of the proceedings. Now, the practical effect is you cannot get financing. The stay of the proceedings, having that language in the bill reduces the effectiveness by the rest of it substantially, because even if they don't ask a stay of the proceedings and thus avoid the bond, the fact that the litigation is there means the financial institution won't loan you the money. See, they can avoid the bond under the present statute by not asking for a stay of the proceedings. but the fact they file a suit has the same effect of because you can't borrow money to proceed. So we're asking that the bond is required whether you ask for a stay of the proceedings or not. Proposing to increase the amount of the bond from $1,000 to $10,000. That change occurring in line 14 and 15. I'll note the other language said an amount not to exceed $1,000, and this language, as I review it, in the way Legislative Council drafted it, appears to, and those of you that are lawyers here can second guess that, but it appears to say that it's $10,000 and doesn't give the judge the option of levying a lesser amount, and that we certainly wouldn't have an objection to the language leaving the end not to exceed language in there. The rest of the changes occur on lines 28 through 35. It's designed to mandate reasonable attorney's fees to the developer and to the local government. The question of the role of the local government being reimbursed for their attorney's fees arose in Marion County, where the bond was required on at least two cases that I know of, and legal counsel for the county called us and inquired if under this statute, as it presently is on the books, the local government could be reimbursed for their costs, for their attorney's fees and costs in their role in defending the writ action. I think they ultimately concluded that they were not eligible, in effect, to be reimbursed. This language would allow them to levy on the bond also. And the final language, of course, provides a proration if that's necessary. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions,
Chair? Representative
Cohen.
Yes, I guess I really do, having been through this hearing once before in the Housing Committee, want to talk about the frivolity and whether, in fact, how many cases we do have that are frivolous cases. And wonder where you get your information that, in fact, we are dealing with frivolous cases.
Is that a question, Representative?
Yes, I'm wondering where he gets his information that has to do with, in fact, we're having frivolous cases.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say the extent to which it's frivolous is in the eyes of the beholder. The case that I have before you, if you review the Harrison Holmes discussion carefully, why, to the extent the letter is true, and I'm accepting it as face value, there's probably, we probably all agree that was frivolous.
Okay, but we have like 5,617 land use decisions since 76, and the information that we were given in another committee said that only 43 decisions were appealed by writ of review, and two-thirds by citizens, one-third by developers, and 0.8% is what we're talking about.
I think if you dug further behind those figures, they might indicate that were not the sum total of all the writ of review cases that were filed in the state. I am not here arguing that there are thousands and thousands of them necessarily. It's our position that even if there are, well, it's like passing a law against murder, even if there are a few, it's not a good idea, and we should try to remedy the problem.
I guess I don't subscribe to the fact that you're going to remedy for a few and you're going to charge a person like myself who is a citizen or a developer who with a legitimate concern that has to put up that kind of money. And I guess I'm...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards?
Didn't mean to interrupt, Representative. How does a citizen go about, what is this process of undertaking $10,000? How do you go about arranging for that before you bring your lawsuit? I don't understand the process.
Presumably you would go to a bonding organization and buy a surety bond, paying some portion of the total value of the bond as the premium for it.
How much would you have to pay?
I guess it would be 10%, maybe a little bit more.
Does it have to be cash?
Typically, I can't really speak to that in very much depth because I haven't done this kind of litigation. Maybe you have, Norm.
Well, it could be that. It could be a 10 or 20% of the actual value, and maybe Fred can answer better than I, but it also could be pledging assets that have a value equivalent to $10,000, too. So you'd have to have a financial sheet in any event to get a bond and perhaps even pledge those assets.
I think that Representative Smith is precisely correct. The committee should not operate under any illusions. To get a $10,000 bond, you have to prove to the bonding company you don't need it. And then if you go the bonding route, I think the 10% figure is in the ballpark as to what you'd probably pay for this kind of a bond.
Good question.
Just so that answer's clear, Fred, you have to prove that you don't need it and pay a premium, don't you?
That's correct. And any of you that have obtained any kind of a bond discover that. We know it, of course, from obtaining builder's board bonds.
Good questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't understand exactly. Say that I wanted to apply for a writ of review and object to a subdivision. And this bill were law, changing it from $1,000 to $10,000 for the benefit of the students, that I had to take out a bond of $10,000. What could I use as security if I just had all I have is a single family house, okay, worth $45,000. Now, how do I go about securing the bond? I don't have a savings account, so I couldn't put up any cash. Could I secure that bond and file this lawsuit against the subdivision without cash? Okay.
Probably through a trust deed on your house.
A second mortgage, like?
No, it's a trust deed. Which is you essentially deed the house over to the, or after to the court, I guess. And the trustee would essentially say that if they execute on the bond, the house is sold, and you get the balance, and they get the $10,000.
Well, except that I think that you'd have to have an equity in excess of $12,500.
Assuming that you met the other... Well, you could probably waive that.
I think you could waive your rights in bankruptcy.
Fred,
let's
be recognized in order here so we don't make it impossible for people doing the tape. Go ahead.
Speak to one question. There is presently in the statute a $100 bond. In addition to the, or maybe I should come back and say there was a $100 undertaking that was put in the statute apparently in the 1860s sometime. That's carried through unchanged, and if you think about the relative value of $100 in the 1860s when they wrote the initial writ of review provisions, that figure is that we're talking about now is not totally unreasonable.
Further questions? Fred, thanks very much. I guess I did have a question before you go, Fred. This is a provision that doesn't itself speak just to frivolous lawsuits.
That is correct.
It speaks with respect to, you take your chances on appeal if you lose, even though you had a very meritorious case on a split decision or where the law was unclear. If you lost, you could be hit for this.
That is correct.
Okay.
We've tried to, frankly, to develop language that we've discussed with the Senate Trade and Economic Development Committee to try to define frivolous lawsuits, and that is, as those of you on the committee know, not an easy undertaking.
Yeah, Representative Lombard.
Fred, if we're going to make this mandatory on the award of attorney's fees, and you know, as you well know, and as Representative Frohmeyer has pointed out, you know, you may get any number of cases that are really very, very close. Going on technicalities, shouldn't we, in the interest of fair play or of fairness, work it both ways?
Well, I don't, I've not discussed that issue specifically with my association. My personal philosophical answer to that question is what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And if you sue and win, which I have done on some occasions, winning is having a $20,000 attorney fee takes a whole bunch of the pleasure out of having won. And at least for the person who's putting up the tab. So that's a principle that I believe in.
Is it, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bevis,
is it happening? I see the horror stories. And are these typical of what you consider to be a much larger problem out there? These, well, symbolic of a lot more that we don't
It's difficult to put your fingers on the precise numbers because they only trickle up. They only trickle up through the system. And there was a survey that 1,000 Friends did. If you, and those statistics, if they're not before you, they presumably will be somewhere along the line. You should look at them very carefully, and maybe it may have been staff that was here that was involved in that survey, or the staff of the committee that was doing a look at the during the interim of the Ritz review. I think you need to ask some questions to get understand the entire picture, but I cannot bring you precise statistics on the number of lawsuits that are involved in development projects. Too, we hear about the bad ones and the ones where because there's no question about it. But what under the present process, you can starve a developer out just by filing lawsuits against him and stretch him out till the project doesn't pencil out anymore. And I would guess that any of the lawyers that are in private practice here could explain to you very quickly how they could do that at really very little cost.
For the questions of the witness. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Does Mr. Vanatta have any comment on 2800, which is also on our agenda today, which relates to the same subject?
He's not signed up on that. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 2284? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2284 and take up House Bill 2894. Mr. Dewey?
What's the number?
2894. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League. You have before you the proposed amendments to House Bill 2894 that came from the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development.
No,
I do not.
Yeah.
No, they're not here. Maybe we should, if you're going to talk about the amendments, maybe we should get some copies maybe before you start talking.
You might, the bill is entirely different, or the amendments are entirely different than the bill.
We really can't consider the bill.
Okay. Do you mind if we have you step down? And be more than happy to step down.
Okay.
We'll move now to public hearing on House Bill 2800. Does Representative Truitt in the audience?
His legislative assistant just left the room.
Okay, how about Don Corson, Eugene? Mr. Corson here.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Corson. I reside at 4995 Central Way in Eugene. I'm testifying in support of the principles embodied in House Bill 2800. This bill, as you know, will reimburse petitioners in land development court cases for costs and disbursements and reasonable attorney fees if the petitioners are supported by appeals court decisions. In my view, this bill is a vitally important and urgently needed piece of legislation. It is required to permit effective achievement of the very first goal of the Oregon Land Conservation and Development Commission. Goal number one, adopted in 1974 and twice reaffirmed by the electorate, states that it is Oregon's policy to develop a citizen involvement program that ensures the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. The spirit of this goal has been undermined by the fact that the costs associated with pursuing land use planning decisions through the courts is an effective barrier to citizen involvement. These costs are an asymmetrical burden, falling most heavily and most unjustly upon those citizens who attempt to ensure local compliance with LCDC goals and guidelines. It is clear that the developer, as a result of the profit motive, has sufficient incentive to press for planning decisions which may not be in the public interest. From the developer's perspective, the cost associated with altering permissible land uses is simply a cost of business, a cost which is recovered when the value of the land increases as a result of the new land use decision. From the citizen's perspective, the costs of appealing a local decision are not business costs at all, but personal costs, expenses borne by one or a few individuals who are acting in the public interest, expenses which will not be recovered no matter what the outcome of the case. This financial disincentive to citizens' participation can only result in an impaired planning process. The strength of our land use planning mechanisms ultimately depends upon an informed and active citizenry. The need for public involvement has recently been underscored by the situation in my own county. In the view of many observers, Lane County is now beginning to experience wholesale subversion of the intent of LCDC goals and guidelines. My support for the concept of House Bill 2800 stems from the belief that the only substantial obstacle to increased citizens' participation in land use planning is financial in nature. This bill allows citizens to recover costs they have incurred in the pursuit of the public good, subject to support of their position by appeals court. The proposed legislation could be further strengthened by amending the bill to permit recovery of court-related costs by petitioners if they are supported by the appeals court, without regard to the outcome of the circuit court decision. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Yeah. Basically, we award attorney's fees when and if, you know, the legislature's court awards them. They usually award them to the prevailing party, which means if you're asking us to allow a petitioner in certain cases attorney's fees if he's successful in the Court of Appeals, should we not allow perhaps the respondent attorney's fees if the petitioner's not successful?
I suppose it depends upon one's philosophical point of view, and I don't claim to impose it upon you. In my view, some individuals have their own economic self-interest at stake in pursuing any kind of land use decision. In other words, they'll make a profit just by a society redefining the use of some parcel of land through no particular economically productive activity of their own. It's a social decision. In other words, some people already have an incentive to go through the court and have a gain at the end of it. On the other hand, there are a whole other class of citizens, largely the citizens of Oregon, who have absolutely nothing to gain economically, typically, in these kinds of cases. And as a result of any court proceedings, they simply lose money They do so in the public good, but gain nothing but, I suppose, the goodwill of their fellow citizens. So from my point of view, there's something to be said for differentiating between classes of people receiving money. But again, that's a philosophical question.
Well, you probably heard Mr. Van Atta from Home Builders testify that that this cost his people that were involved in this process rather large sums of money. And just be, you know, is an economic interest less valuable than, say, a citizen participation interest?
What I'm trying to point out, Chairman, is that that economic interest is already being served by our economic system. In other words, we're already ensuring that there's a profit motive, an economic return of one's activity for the certain class of persons, those that are trying to develop certain articles of property. And if, in fact, it is a decision of our court systems that that particular land use decision is not appropriate, then it should be the citizens that attempt to make sure that we're complying with LCDC goals and guidelines. They should be reimbursed. On the other hand, if the appeals court finds that it is the developer in the right, as I'm sure will be the case in some cases, then that person will receive the economic rewards associated with reclassifying the appropriate use of that land.
What about the cost of going through the system?
That's part of the cost of doing business if you're a business person, as I am.
Further questions on the witness?
Yeah, Mr. Corson, on this may not be a question to which you want to speak, but from whom will a person in the contemplation of legislation in fact recover costs and disbursements? It's, I gather, an appeal of an order of a land use planning body, which is not a court, am I correct?
You probably need to state that question once again, okay, if you don't understand it.
Well, let me put it a different way. A city planning commission or a city council could either have approved or denied the project. It is the basis of this suit. Now, assuming that the citizen is on one side and the developer is on the side of the city, who pays the attorney's fees?
For which party?
Excuse me?
For which party? The citizen's party or the...
No, the citizen who brought the suit challenging the city's decision,
yes,
which was urged upon it by the developer who prevailed at the administrative level. Who's supposed to pay the cost, the city or the developer?
I assume at this point in time the city is the one that bears the burden of the court at the appeal level. The developer incurs costs before the appeal level, in other words, at the administrative level. Is that correct?
I would assume both.
My assumption that is the current status of the law, yeah, in Oregon.
Okay, I'm just trying to get in my mind how it works and who's on the hook, whether it's the local government or whether it's the developer.
My understanding is, maybe incorrect, I'd be welcome any correction from the lawyers present, that before the appeals process, court process, it's the developer's financial burden. Afterwards, it becomes a city's burden, or the local government burden.
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
There's a representative of Representative Troop here who wishes to testify. Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
I'd like to welcome students from Columbia High School in East Multnomah County who are here on a social studies project to learn about the legislative process for the day. There'll be a group of students visiting each day this week.
Great. We're very happy to have you here. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 2800?
Can we take the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to ask one of the other sponsors who's on the committee what his interpretation of the...
Well, I am a co-sponsor of this legislation, as you astutely noted, Representative Smith. And I don't know the answer to my own question, or I would not put Mr. Corson on the hook. I don't quite know what's intended.
I don't quite understand the language of the bill. I think we've got the defendant and the respondent and the appellant.
No, I haven't.
But I think I know what the...
Stevens just was out there. I know what the concept of the bill is, but I'm not sure.
Okay, if there's no one else to testify on that, let's set that one aside for a minute and
will take Representative Group when he shows up. Mr. Van Atta, House Bill 2560.
I am Fred Van Atta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association to discuss House Bill 2560. Let me explain the history of this legislation, and it'll fall into context for you then as I explain what it is the intent of the bill to accomplish. We have had the residential construction industry has had an ongoing conflict with the Building Codes Division for a year and a half or thereabouts over the adoption of vapor barriers. And that you want me to
if you would
defend this.
Sure. Okay, Representative Troop, would you like to come up and testify on House Bill 2800? Thank you, Mr. Van Manen. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
For the benefit of the students that are here, this is the bill that I described briefly to you in the hall that comes from the other direction of the issue of lawsuits over land development. Representative Trooper will explain.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the, running up a few flights of stairs. For the record, my name is Representative Tom Troop, representing Klamath and Deschutes counties. Prior to going into House Bill 2800, I would like to offer some amendments, and I believe those amendments are currently being delivered to you. And I would like to go through this very simple amendment first and then go into the text of my presentation. The amendment on line 6, strike the colon after if and add petitioner substantially prevails on the merits, and then strike lines 7, 8, and 9. After submitting the original draft, we had an opportunity to talk with several attorneys involved in land use litigation and discovered that circuit court judgments usually have a strong presumption that the original decision was valid. In the new form, the bill would treat developers and citizen groups equally, premising recovery upon appellate decision on the merits. I provided you with a copy of the California Civil Code of Procedure, section 1021.5, which is a similar law passed with the 77 California Assembly after Serrano versus Priestley. The California law is broader than what we are contemplating here in that it is available for any suit, quote, in the public interest, including presumably parents' suits over school busing. Woodland Hills Residents Association versus City of Los Angeles is a California case that was brought because of section 1021.5, and that's also included.
I note in the California statute that the award is to a, quote, a successful party, unquote, as opposed to your bill, which deals with just the petitioner. I believe that's even with the amendments. It says that the petitioner shall recover costs and disbursements and reasonable attorney's fees if the petitioner substantially prevails on the merits. What happens in the situation where the petitioner brings the case to the Court of Appeals and does not succeed on the merits? Should we, as a public policy matter, allow the respondent attorney's fees and costs? He would be the successful party under the California statute, but would not be entitled to recovery under this statute, as I read it.
That's very true. That is the way the bill has been drafted.
Well, is that a conscious decision on your part, or is that, do you want it broader so that it's a successful party, or do you want it just petitioners? And if you've decided on just petitioners, why?
You want to?
The California law was brought to our attention as a possible model, and at that time we talked about whether or not to parallel it, and decided that since we had initially intended to concern ourselves with land use decisions and petitioners in those decisions, to keep it to that. Certainly some of the language in section 1021.5 could be adapted or modified into 2800, but that wasn't the original intent.
Mr. Chairman, can the witness identify himself?
Yes, please.
My name is Randy Stevens, legislative assistant.
Well, all through our law, we have prevailing party as basically the person wherein the statutes would give a right of recovery for attorney's fees. As I understand, I'm not completely clear, but is it your intention not to award that to all prevailing parties, but just to successful petitioners?
Well, that was the way the bill is written, and I'm not sure, Representative Gardner. I'd like to pursue that one a little further.
Representative Smith?
If it needs pursuing, Representative Troop, I would say that I'd have a difficult time supporting the bill in its present form unless it were related to both parties, and in which case I'd be more inclined to support it if it were melded with another bill that we have here today. But it would require that before I could vote for it.
Did you have something further?
I wanted to go through the testimony on the measure, if that's appropriate this time.
Representative Lombard has a question.
Well, let him finish his testimony, then he may answer it.
The basic legislative policy underlying Oregon's land use laws is to ensure the highest possible level of livability in Oregon, ORS 197.010. To accomplish this policy, the legislature declared that there would be coordinated comprehensive planning throughout the state at all levels of government. Planning is coordinated when during the planning process, the needs of all levels of government, semi-public and private agencies, and the citizens of Oregon have been considered and accommodated as much as possible, 197.015. A major goal of the state's current land use planning statutes is to encourage citizen involvement so as to ensure the opportunity for citizens to be active in all phases of the planning process. It follows that such involvement should not be limited to the planning and implementation processes where land use decisions are concerned. The availability of meaningful citizen access to the process of judicial review is indispensable in any regulatory scheme said to be justified by interests of public welfare. House Bill 2800, by relieving citizens of financial burdens inherent in the structure of appellate review, will make the cost of judicial consideration more equitable and provide an incentive for heightened involvement in the future. The result will be a more efficient resolution of competing interests, which in turn allows for the best implementation of the underlying statutory policies. Present law provides alternative initial procedures for review of local land use decisions, of which the petition for review to the LCDC is one. The other contained in Chapter 34 of ORS is the writ of review, which deals with all non Administrative Procedure Act agencies, cities and counties for the most part. This procedure gives any party to any process before any inferior court, officer, or tribunal the right to appeal to the circuit court and to have the decision rendered below reviewed for errors. Under this procedure, any individual or group of individuals has access to the courts to challenge land conservation and development actions. ORS 34.055 outlines the specific writ of review procedures where land development projects are involved. Under this statute, a plaintiff in a writ of review action involving a land development project must post a bond to cover costs and attorney fees incurred by the developer if a stay of the land development project in question is granted pending review. Present law states that the amount of bond is not to exceed $1,000. And obviously the bill 2284 that you just heard would increase this to $10,000. While said to be justified by the cost of delay, such financial conditions may well serve to inhibit full utilization of the appeals process by citizens without the necessary financial resources. The cost of appeal can obviously discourage the filing of petitions for writs of review, a detriment to citizen involvement in the review of land development as a result. Yet, what about the cost of further judicial appeal beyond the writ of review stage in the circuit court? Just as any amount of bonding poses a threat to involvement at the circuit court level, the imposition of costs, disbursements, and attorney fees upon challenging parties in the appellate courts creates the potential for further chilling effects upon the exercise of legal rights. House Bill 2800 speaks directly to the issue of allocation of costs and disbursements and reasonable attorney fees for an appeal from a judgment of the circuit court in a writ of review proceeding is at issue. The bill would allow recovery for the petitioner of such costs upon one condition, if the petitioner substantially prevails in the merits. Provisions to the contrary, allowing the recovery of costs and fees by the defendant, even if the petitioner wins on appeal, is exemplary of a process that is unjustly biased in favor of development interests. Such financial risks and burdens, which currently must be borne by those challenging local land use decisions, can serve to foreclose meaningful citizen appeals. The sheer cost of pursuing these cases through the court systems constitutes a serious constraint to the effectiveness of the state's land use planning laws. Under this bill, the statutory and judicial bias that exists towards government bodies would be reduced. Most land use decisions by local bodies carry a heavy presumption of validity, thus making them difficult to overturn. By adding a financial burden to this presumption that the petitioner must overcome, the courts may cut off many legitimate claims. While proposing no radical change, House Bill 2800 will have far-reaching effects. It in reality makes the appeal of legitimate claims cost-free, for the bill covers only appeals initiated by the defendant after the circuit court has reversed the decision of such defendant. Thus, the petitioner is relieved of the bond responsibility of ORS 34.055, and if the appellate court affirms the circuit court decision, the petitioner bears no cost. The bill would encourage full pursuit of an issue through the judicial process, by alleviating the fear that somewhere along the line the financial hammer will fall. The value of judicial review of land development carried on throughout the state is not to be underestimated. A system that imposes costs upon those least able to bear them threatens to eliminate from a review process Oregon's most dedicated and experienced planners, its citizens. As the facilitation of citizen involvement in all levels of land use planning is one of Oregon's primary public policies, LCDC Goal 1, the legislature needs to act to ensure that the doors of the judiciary are open to all. Thank you.
Person Lombard?
Tom, one of the things that I seem to be reading in lots of reports coming out of the Housing Division and other ad hoc committees studying housing costs and what have you, is that by tacking on a lot of these so-called development costs that, of course, one of the previous witnesses said can easily be passed on to the ultimate purchasers, so from a policy standpoint, what we're really doing is pricing housing out of the reach of most of the people in Oregon now. And it seems to me that, let's just philosophically here, we're going to tack on some other mandatory costs by this type of a proposal, ultimately, to the cost of housing in Oregon, and we're just going to put housing further out of reach of people. What's your reaction to, how you view this as affecting the ultimate cost of housing in Oregon?
My initial assumption would be that the cost impact would be very minor, because the only time that this cost would be incurred where it would have to be passed on would be that if a petitioner were to go into the courts and prevail after a decision below that review, it would have to be a decision that is reversed. So I don't see the cost impact being that great from this particular procedure. What the intent behind this is to allow all citizens the opportunity to challenge those kinds of decisions that are made, and if you're able to overturn a prior decision, to have those costs paid for them and not have to bear that responsibility. So I see a very small cost impact.
Sure.
All right, well, let me carry your idea a little bit further in just in terms of how you anticipate this would apply. Literally, in reading the proposal, it applies only on appeals from the circuit court to the Court of Appeals. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. And what you're saying is that, in your view, the cost of that appeal really is going to be the minimal cost in the whole appellate process. Is that right?
I'm not certain. I don't know what the cost of
those appellate costs are. Let me suggest this, Tom, because if you're, you know, if your justification for this type of proposal is that it would encourage more citizen participants to litigate land use decisions, let me suggest that by far the much greater costs in litigation occur beneath that level. And in fact, it occur not only at the initial hearings level, but also in the appeals to the circuit court.
The intent is not to initiate more citizens' involvement at the lower level, but once they are involved in that process, to not block their becoming involved in a higher level in that process if they feel that they are right and they're in a position where the cost of carrying that a step further will prohibit them from going that final step.
Do you, Mr. Chairman, do you feel that a significant number of citizens are being discouraged from going beyond the circuit court level because of their inability to get attorney's fees?
Well, I don't have any handle on numbers. I've had some information from my own county in Deschutes that have indicated there are a couple of different citizens groups that would have liked to have gone further, but they did stop their own efforts because of their inability to raise the funds. Also, I believe it was late last fall, the Eugene Registered Guard also carried an editorial strongly supporting this concept and indicating that Lane County had some difficulties in this regard. I can't remember the exact case. What is it?
Cone breeding
annexation case in Lane County. This situation occurred.
Further, Mr. Chairman. The language of the bill reads in terms of the petitioner. Now, you're aware that a petitioner could be a developer, too.
Exactly aware of that.
And is it your intention that, for instance, if a citizens group prevails at the circuit court level and a developer takes the case to the Court of Appeals and gets the circuit court decision overturned, that the developer ought to be entitled to attorney's fees from the citizens group?
Yes, if that process is reversed, I think he should have equal opportunity at that also. This bill is not an attempt to get at the developer or not an attempt to give the person fighting land use decisions a freedom that other people do not enjoy. Developers and other citizens that are trying to stop possible land use decisions would equally be able to have this advantage, yes.
So you think it should cut both ways?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and then finally my question is, you used the phrase petitioner substantially prevailed. Now, this is a lawyer asking a non-lawyer, of course, what that means, but have you done any research or received any information from the lawyers that you've been consulting with as to what substantially prevails would mean?
I'd like to refer that question to Randy, if I could, Kim. Okay.
We were referred to the California Code of Civil Procedure, and it was suggested that there may be some guidelines in there or perhaps some guidelines listed in the Woodland Hills Residents Association case, but essentially it's our intent that if a citizen is successful at the appeals court level in proving that the development decision was not in compliance with existing land use ordinances, then that would be substantially prevailing.
Randy, on that point, substantially prevails can mean a number of different things. One can mean you almost won, but didn't quite. Or it can mean you won and won big, prevailed substantially. Or third, and this may be what you're saying, but I'm not sure, it could mean that you prevailed and that the case was a substantial one in that you vindicated a large public interest that otherwise would not have been vindicated had you not brought the action. Now, which ones of those?
I think
you're... There may be more categorizations, but it strikes me it could mean three different things, and they're all very different in terms of their consequences.
Your third statement comes close to what our intent was.
So prevailed and that there is a substantial benefit to the development of the law or to a previously unrepresented class or...
Exactly.
That kind of policy which seems to be embodied in California statute.
Exactly.
Okay.
Any verbiage changes that need to be made, I think that's one of the real advantages to having this committee. You have seven attorneys, and like Kip pointed out, I'm very lay when it comes to these kinds of concepts, so any assistance you can provide would really be appreciated. I'm just trying to point up a problem and assist in working towards a solution.
Further questions? Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else to testify on 2800? Okay, if not, we'll return to 2560, Mr. Van Natta.
Ready to continue the saga of vapor printers.
You still have no comments on 2800?
I thought I understood substantially prevailed. But I think I would only confuse you further. House Bill 2560. Maybe in terms of background, I should step back one step and remind the committee that there exists by judicial fiat in Oregon an implied warranty on the sale of real property. In my own layman's terms, roughly, warranty of habitability, suitability of materials, and workmanship. The net effect of that is that a great many people in the builder vendors of residential structures are always worrying about being sued if the customer is unhappy with the house they get. We were looking at a provision of the building code that many of our members had reason to believe would cause serious deterioration to the dwelling and would result in litigation. The solution that we came to in how to cope with the litigation was to transfer the liability from the builder to the Department of Commerce, the State of Oregon, the people adopting the building code. If the builder built the house in conformance with the code and the damage that resulted was a direct result of the provisions of the code, where it could apply in the vapor barrier case is as you wrap your house, moisture cannot escape through the walls, and if you fail to leave your windows open or the door open to get the ventilation, you, in some kinds of circumstances, can get mildew and mold and rot, and even the cases reported where the drywall has accumulated so much moisture that it begins to sag. It could be in certain kinds of circumstances demonstrated that results as a direct result of a provision of the building code. The lawyers that we talked to did not believe that the builder simply pleading defense, I build it the way the state told me to build it, would be sufficient defense. And this concept arose directly out of that problem. When, and it now appears we have the vapor barrier question in hand, the Energy Conservation Board, week before last, voted not to include the vapor barrier, and the Structural Codes Advisory Board endorsed that last week, and I think today or Friday or last Friday, the Director of the Department of Commerce signed an order saying that they would not require vapor barriers. The more we...
Mr. Van Natta, Representative Smith and I seem to, I think, have bells going off. Are you sure there isn't some
there's some defense there, not mistake of law, but something out of my law school past seems to be nagging at me. Maybe Representative Frohmeyer.
Force majeure.
I think somebody's overlooked something because there's something somewhere that if you do something according to the law, on the other hand, if you don't, it can be interpreted as negligence per se.
This is a technical question, first, Fred. If the Energy Conservation Board and the SCAB Board had together agreed that there should not only be vapor barriers, but also dehumidifiers, then we wouldn't have a problem, would we?
Well, the specific example that I discussed would not occur, but there is a substantial amount of theory, and I will, having spent a lot of time on vapor barriers in the last year, I don't want to tell you all that I think I may have learned about the controversy about vapor barriers, but just putting them in the wall could cause moisture to accumulate in the wall. I cited one example. The vapor barriers could cause other moisture problems in the wall that a dehumidifier doesn't solve. And I say as an example, the mold inside was just one kind of an example. Even with the vapor barrier problem solved, as we keep pushing in our building code, we've moved beyond proven, tried and true technology in lots of cases, and we're pushing the frontiers, if you will, of our technical and materiel availability. Our guy said, gee, that's a good bill. You ought to take it down there and talk about it with them anyway. That it's probably a good concept, you know, whatever happens on vapor barriers. The issue and circumstance you're trying to get at is when there is damage to the dwelling or the customer, the homeowner, is injured as a direct result of a provision of the code, and that the builder has got to demonstrate he complied with the code and the damage is as a result of that.
You'd have a causation. You'd obviously have to have a causation requirement. Presumably that would take expert testimony to establish whether or not...
Clearly it would have to be demonstrated. And I, you know, that was the best effort in the language was to place that burden on the builder if he's going to pass his liability to the state. He's got to prove that the damage was a direct result of a provision of the building code.
You're now moving away from the language or indirectly resulting. It appears in line 5 of the bill.
No pressure. Well, I used directly.
What's the difference between directly and indirectly?
I guess that the legal implications of the difference I don't understand, but the vapor barrier itself does not directly cause the house to fall down. It's the moisture that accumulates and rots the dwelling, and in my mind, that's what indirectly means. But maybe legally it means something different. But if you see what I'm saying. It would still, using that example, be caused by the code provision requiring the barrier.
Questions to the witness? Did you have anything further? Or?
No, I think that...
Representative Frohmeyer.
Well, Fred, you envision, I guess, or at least the bill's draft envisions, a total shift of responsibility from the developer, who otherwise might bear the risk, to the state, which imposed that requirement. The bill doesn't seem to contemplate any situation of concurrent liability. Would you mean to preclude that? That's, let's say, where you use technique, but also the builder's at fault in not having done certain other things that would render that technique less harmful under the circumstances. Typically now that would be I suppose the builder would be totally answerable now, but would you envision a shared liability, or is this an indemnity situation where you simply shift the loss from one to the other?
Frankly, it was not an issue that we contemplated. You know, as a
statement. As a policy matter, my reaction is if the builder bears some responsibility, he ought to be in, presumably ought to share the liability. Maybe the case would arise if we go back to the vapor barrier and the interior moisture damage. Maybe there the state would say, well, it's not really the fault of us in requiring the vapor barrier. If the builder had gone ahead and installed vents in the ceiling, or cut a hole in the wall to allow ventilation, or install a dehumidifier, why the installation of the vapor barrier wouldn't have caused a problem, and therefore the places the liability and responsibility back on the builder. I'm not giving you a very clear answer to your question because I'm not sure there is one.
Do you have any idea as to how much may have been collected in the way of damages as a result of the vapor barrier incident among home building entities?
Well, there have been none because the vapor barriers have not been required. Well, the kind that were a source of controversy and concern about creating damaged structures have never been required in the state, and I think I'm happy to report that at least for the immediate future, they won't be. That doesn't mean that there may not be a variety of other kinds of problems that arise out of the building code that that could make this kind of legislation meaningful.
Are you aware of any other specific instances where a builder has complied with the state building code and as a direct result of that compliance has been sued and had to pay monetary damages?
No, I am not. I am not aware of any such specific instances. I'm very straightforward with you. This hit me at 4 o'clock in the morning, this concept did, when I was trying to figure out how you cope with the being sued over the vapor barriers coming online, and then the more we looked at it, why the more it looked like maybe it was an idea that ought to be carried forward, notwithstanding any controversy over the vapor barriers.
Representative Cohen, then Representative Lombard.
I guess my question's been answered.
Representative Lombard.
Fred, the very first thing, of course, that came to my mind when I saw this bill was probably been having a galvanized pipe. Are you aware of that little big issue that we've had? Briefly, and I know the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee, of course, has gone a little bit over this issue. The Trade and Economic Development Committee in the interim, the Water Policy Advisory Committee, of which I was a member, spent a great deal of time on this. And very simply, the issue is that we've got a bunch of galvanized pipe that has been imported, mostly from Korea, and has just created all kinds of havoc for those structures, including homes, the Eagle Point High School, among others. In fact, what they had to do was go in and replumb all of the Eagle Point High School where the water was to be used for drinking purposes rather than just pure washing purposes, because of the problems in the pipe, and EPA's done some significant studies on this and so forth. And I'll tell you, my plumbers would love this bill.
I am familiar with the issue, but I am not sure, and frankly, never connected the two of them in my mind. I think if you read the language of the bill carefully, because I have members who are also caught up in litigation as a result of the installation of some of that pipe, and I'm sure they're looking for their, where they subcontracted, they're looking for their plumbers. I don't see how you could jump through that hoop with this issue, because the code, you know, requires plumbing, and in some cases it may require galvanized pipe, but I don't think it would address the issue of, you know, galvanized pipe that is not adequately galvanized.
Yeah, I grant you that, and actually I guess I'm talking more in terms of the philosophy of the bill, because the galvanized pipe, in fact, was approved by the Health Division, and that is part of the process. The other thing, though, that I would ask you, and general philosophical bent, and I've got a great deal of sympathy for builders and installers who get caught in this type of a bind where they've received previous government approval. But what do you do, the State Department of Agriculture, the Department of Forestry, that has previously approved the application of 245T, and then discovers, you know, sometime later, or is told sometime later that it has caused all kinds of problems? Do you then allow a cause of action for those people who think all of a sudden they can connect their ills and maladies to the application of a previously approved chemical, give them a cause of action against the state for that approval? Seems to me that's a possible logical extension of this kind of an approach that would allow a state, you know, a cause of action against the state, which I guess in a sense is made some legislative decisions about building codes, construction materials, chemicals, applications, and what have you. It's more by way of comment, I guess, than a question.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Rutherford?
I think Kip touched on one thing that I was wondering about, and that is suppose the materials are defectively made. Granted an immunity here for the use of materials, construction materials, but the question that he's raising is suppose those materials, even though used, are defectively made. The other question I would have, it says or techniques, and I'm not just sure what you mean by techniques in this context, whether that...
Well, if... The building code is not in all cases a performance code.
Right.
And I am, it's a very major document, and I could produce people that could point out to you where it, in effect, prescribes certain, where it is not just an end performance or end product, but prescribes certain techniques.
Okay, so I thought you wanted to limit this to vapor burners, but you would like to go beyond vapor burners.
Very clearly, I used... The genesis of the bill is the vapor barrier problem, but as we looked at the concept, even with the vapor barrier question laid to rest, we thought it was a good principle.
Okay. Suppose the code said that thou shalt install some material and thou shalt do it by hammering it with a nail to the wall, being a technique. And the hammering of the nail to the wall was done negligently so that somehow someone was injured. Now, the person did the technique. They performed the technique. They hammered the nail to the wall, but they did it defectively. They were negligent. Would they now be immune?
Well, you know as well as I, the court would look at the language on the face of it. Ultimately make a judgment. I do not believe that there was no intent to provide a defense for negligence on the part of the builder in this legislation, and we didn't address, I don't think, as I recall the language, we did not address negligence on the part of installation in any way, shape, or form.
So what you're saying then is that if the technique is performed in a non-negligent manner, but the technique is defective, then liability would fall.
That is precisely the case that we are trying to address.
Representative Cohen.
Yes, well, I participated in a peripheral way with the vapor barrier question. My concern about this bill is if we take the responsibility really away from those boards. And you have a real fallback that says, well, it doesn't make any difference because if anything, if it's not right, it's the state's responsibility and they're liable. I'd be concerned that we wouldn't really get down to the true facts the way we've done, albeit you've had a hassle and a road to go to educate people. But don't you think that's part of the process in terms of both the boards and everybody concerned?
Your question, may I rephrase it? You're saying that, be specific, the home builders won't care what's in the building code anymore because they don't have to worry about being sued by their unhappy customer if it's wrong.
Well, not only the home builders, but other people who are involved in the whole process, you know, that we get involved in. I mean, people who are on the boards and all of us too. I mean, everybody.
Certainly, the danger of being sued is an incentive for us to try to bring right and justice and common sense into the building code. But we have other incentives also, and I think that we would continue to be as vigilant as we are to make sure the code is at least halfway reasonable and will produce a product that we can be proud of to present to our customers. Because that, after all, is the marketplace is the ultimate test, and the customer ought to be happy with what they get.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Smith.
Fred, maybe this was discussed when I was out of the room, but you need the statute, Section 2 specifically, to overcome the state's natural immunity from that kind of suit?
That is as it was explained to me. I regret my counsel my counsel and legislative counsel joined in the preparation of the final document that's before you, and I would get one of them to visit with you about that kind of a question.
I'm wondering if everyone else feels that there is a natural immunity in the first place that the state has, because if we don't start from that, and there is no immunity, and it seems to me you could just be impleading or making a third-party defendant the state in every action that seems to be coming up under this as it is. So you must feel you need the enabling legislation.
Was my understanding that the state essentially was that, you know, the king was essentially immune to being sued. You had to get his permission to sue him.
I suppose this comment may have been made, too, in my absence, but this principle would have to be applied to an awful lot more people than just home builders in this state if you wanted to go that route. For every single regulation we have in the state that affects a special interest, I think we would have the obligation to consider relieving them of liability if the state were wrong. Whether it be a home builder or a doctor or a radiologist or anybody else that followed state regulations that did it to the letter and the spirit of the law that found that the law was wrong, that person should be entitled to the same third-party indemnity that you're asking for.
May I?
Go ahead, Fred.
I am not familiar with all regulations everywhere, but probably in few cases do you find the detailed and extensive kinds of regulation that you do in the building industry. You speak of the medical profession, and if there was if I may make light of it, a carving code for the surgeon that said exactly how you went in and how you did this and then you did this and then you did that, I would personally have some sympathy for the doctor that was here saying, if I've got to do it precisely this way and it is wrong, I don't want to be sued for it. The point on the building code is the some 50,000 pieces that we put together in an average residential dwelling, some of them have got to fit together very precisely and include very precise techniques that are required by the code. And we seem to be requiring more of them every day. And this places a burden on those people adopting those regulations to give some thought to whether they are going to cause damage.
Representative Rutherford.
Representative Cohen touched on a facet of this that troubled me a little bit, and that is, wouldn't the long-range effects of this be to create a too cozy relationship between the regulated industry and the board, for this reason, that the regulated industry would want more and more incorporated into the code, because the more that's incorporated into the code, the less liability that they have.
that's an interesting and fascinating concept. I think that's probably not a danger with the home building industry. Now, it may be somewhere else. Our record of advocating more and more regulation is a pretty thin book, Representative Rutherford.
But this might, you see what I'm saying, the thrust of that might change. It's sort of like, you know, Briar Rabbit and Briar Fox, don't throw them into that briar patch, because in the briar patch is safety.
I will reflect on your point.
Good question. Thanks, Jeff. Anyone else testifying on House Bill 2560?
Just want to tell us about 2800, Willie.
Mike, what do you hear
down in favor
on
2894?
Okay. Mr. Young, did you have to get back at some reasonable time?
The Senate Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing, and I've heard that personally.
All right, we'll take you right now then. Senate Bill 216.
Did you say the mark been added down in favor of 2800?
The only advantage, the only utility in taking Larry at any point is if you've got the right votes in the room.
Is this a partisan bill?
No.
Not that. It's just that.
No. This is a bill that was passed out last Monday. Came back to committee Thursday for slight amendments, putting in the words adopted in two places, and then a motion to pass it out to the floor failed 4-2. And I count five votes here now, and I think it'll be 5-0 if everybody votes the way they voted in the past.
I'm going to take the bill from the table, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rutherford moves to take House Bill or Senate Bill 216 from the table.
206.
I think.
216.
Oh, 216. Pardon.
Okay.
But don't forget 206.
Yes.
All right. Discussion. Objection.
Ordered. I move 206. 216. I'm not forgetting. 216 was largely passed.
Representative Rutherford moves to Senate Bill 216 to the floor with the due pass recommendation
as amended.
As amended. Mm-hmm. All right. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman, would you restate the amendments for me, please?
Well, we're going to have Ms. Jim do that right now.
The amendments in the from the A-Rose version of the bill. Let's see. I don't have a perfect copy here, but I believe in line 10 on page 2 of the bill, the word any has been struck and the word no one has been inserted. On line 11 of the bill, after the word born, insert or adopted. On line 13 of the bill, strike the word any and insert known. And on line 28 of the bill, after the word born, insert comma adopted.
Mr. Chairman, we moved and adopted those amendments before the bill was tabled, I believe.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, but I appreciate it, too, because I did this last week when I was...
There's no amendments today.
Correct.
These are all
the difference in the amendments that you're facing today from the ones you faced last Monday are basically in lines 11 and 28, the adopted was put in.
Do you have any 30-second pitch you want to make for the bill or against the bill, Mr. Chairman?
At risk of losing it?
I'll keep quiet.
Dennis, do you have any additional comments?
No.
All right. Clerk, call roll.
Representative Cohen?
Aye.
Strohmeyer?
Aye.
Fugit?
Aye.
Walmart?
Aye.
Richard?
Nope.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Carries.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Would you call my name?
Yes, you did. I moved it.
There's another bill that's floating around, just like this one was floating around. That's 2849. That's the mandatory imprisonment for felony gun crimes. And that's going to be on tomorrow's agenda. It's not on your little pink slip that you're receiving to tell you what's coming up for tomorrow. So the clerk asked me to inform you that's on for tomorrow's agenda.
What was the number again?
2849. The reason that thing's still floating around, you passed it out in Duke County, it's Wilhelmsville. And then we got word of a major fiscal impact associated with it. And at that point, we just stopped it. And it'll be back up tomorrow, assuming we have a form.
Okay. Mike? House Bill 2894.
Dennis, may I have a copy of that also?
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League. You have now before you copies of proposed amendments to House Bill 2894. These amendments were developed with the cooperation and the support of the Oregon Bankers Association, their attorneys, and the Council for the Oregon Wheat Growers League. And they are substantially different from the bill that is printed, House Bill 2894. But first of all, I should explain the problem to you, and then we can perhaps go through the amendments very quickly. Try not to take very much of your time. The bill arises out of a problem that occurred in eastern Oregon with two cooperatives in Helix and in Union County, and the facts are very much similar. And one thing that we're talking about the production of wheat, primarily grain, and one of the considerations that is necessary to understand is that in Oregon, about, and in the Pacific Northwest, about 85% of the wheat grown is white wheat and it's exported. The problem is when farmers sell on contract, and normally they sell on contract for within payment of 30 days, and basically what they do is they contract for a certain price, and it's a situation where there's an exchange of wheat for a certain price. And in both cases, the cooperatives did not have enough money to pay the farmers when the time came due, and the only way that they could raise enough money was to sell the wheat that they had bought, and they basically then put it through the trade. That's the terminology that they use. And the trade is the export trade. And what happens in that case is that they've got to ship the wheat or the grain to Portland, and that can take a shipload doesn't take very long, but when you have some financial problems and getting a lot of grain or wheat out of your warehouses, it can take a long period of time from either truck or barge and truck to the various elevators in the Portland area for export. And then when the co-op gets their money, they in turn would pay the farmer. Now, part of the problem, and there's no question that there was some mismanagement in the areas of both cooperatives. The Bank of Spokane, a cooperative bank in this case, in both cases stepped in to secure their security. They recognized with the financial problems that their security was in jeopardy. And primarily their security would be the elevators and other personal property. But what happens is that when the wheat was sold to the cooperatives, the ownership transferred, and the grain or the wheat became security also for the banks, and they took advantage of that, and there's no question that they had the right to do so, and they were smart in doing that. And one of the things that they recognized, that there was a substantial sum of money that could be was easily convertible into cash. It was coming back through the trade, and in both cases it was about $1 million. And so what basically occurred was that the Bank of Spokane, the Bank of Cooperatives, would receive payments since they had security in that case. And so basically what House Bill 2894 would allow, it would allow for the farmer not to lose the ownership, an interest in the ownership of the grain. He would have a lien until he had received payment. And though that's basically the situation as to what happened. Once he sold his grain, he no longer had an interest in that grain. The co-op had an interest. The bank had an interest in the co-op. In the LeGrand situation, it eventually went into receivership, and it took quite some time for the farmers in that area to receive payment. So with that, I will
quickly, if I may, go through the bill and discuss that with you. As I said, the proposed amendments to the bill that you now have before you were developed in cooperation with the Oregon Wheat Growers League, the Council for the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and the Oregon Bankers Association, and I understand that they support this particular measure now. And they've kind of written off on it. The purpose of the bill then would, as we would recommend having it amended.
Yes, that's good.
Well, if you're going to talk about who's in favor of it, can you tell me who drafted it? And is there anybody that you know of who's against it?
Okay. The Committee on Trade, it's a funny way how this bill started the course, but the Committee on Trade and Economic Development was given 10 days to have this bill. They had it in their possession, but they theoretically could not change it or not amend it. They had to provide a recommendation, and you have the recommendation to you. The first draft was from Legislative Council, and then the bill is now amended before you. The attorneys for both parties worked out the amendments.
Be more specific. Attorneys?
For the Oregon Bankers Association on one hand and the Oregon Wheat Growers League.
Okay, and how about Legislative Council?
Legislative Council, I believe, has seen part of it, but I don't know if they have seen the entire text at this point.
Okay, and was there any identified party interested in the bill that opposed this form that came out?
I know of no party that is opposed to the measure.
Sure. Oh, Chairman.
I thought you recognized yourself.
That's all right. I'll recognize myself.
Mike, is the principal difference between the amendments and the bill the recording of the lien?
That's part of it. There are some specific differences. First of all, we have narrowed it down. The bankers had a real problem with the definition of what an agricultural producer was. So we narrowed it to a individual farmer who raises or grows grain before the definition was berries, fruit, other agricultural products. That's part of it.
You say individual, you mean that an incorporated farmer should not claim the benefits of that?
Means any person who grows or raises grain. So it could be a corporate farm in this instance. The other primarily problem was the situation with the lien and the language. I have to look at it. The bankers had a real problem with the Section 2, Sub 3, where it provides that the lien created by this section is prior and superior to all other liens. They had a real problem with that. And so we had to work out language. The real problem with the bill as it was drafted is that there's a difference in when you use a cooperative, you use it for two purposes. You use it for a warehouse purpose and for a merchandising purpose. And the bill is not very specific in those areas, and they are confusing. And so we really had no other choice but to speak to a lien situation where the farmer retained ownership, but made it clear that he retained ownership and what he had to do in filing and so forth.
If I may,
go ahead.
I have received a letter from one of my local elevator operators stating opposition to this bill. Has that been usual? You said that you didn't know of any opposition.
I do not know of any opposition. And I imagine he could be opposed to the 2894 as written. I don't know what his opposition is.
I'll be happy to share his letter with you, but he basically his letter concerns itself primarily with Senate Bill 72, and then he continues to say hope you can do all you can to defeat this bill and also the House bill, which we understand has been introduced and relates to the same issue.
Two entirely different bills. Entirely different. 72 and
I understand
this bill.
That, but he does express opposition to it.
I would like to talk to him and find out what his opposition is.
Okay.
Basically, here's where it gets down to this, I guess, to the bottom line. The individual farmer who was financed through a bank or a PCA in the Union County situation had no problem because the liens were filed and perfected, and they were in line. The farmer that financed themselves was out on a limb. He eventually got paid, but it took a quite long period of time for him to get payment. And there was a lot of money due. And they, after that, had to restructure the cooperative there. And this bill merely provides that he has an interest in his grain or the proceeds thereof until it is sold and he receives payment. And then there is a provision for going through and how you file a lien after a 90-day period and so forth. But I don't know, it's hard for me to imagine where the local elevator would be coming from on this. But I would like to talk to him about it because he is dealing with the first bill and not the amended bill, and I would like to discuss that with him. As I said, basically what we are doing is we are providing a lien for those individuals that produce or raise grain, and they shall have a lien on their grain and the proceeds thereof until they are paid for the grain. And the lien would attach on the date the grain is sold or on the date the agricultural producer delivers the grain to the purchaser, whichever occurs last. And I think the important thing is, in this particular bill, is that for the first 90 days, on the period whichever occurs last, the producer does not have to file notice or perfect a lien. But in the second 90 days, if he has not been paid, he at that point in time must, through the normal course of channels in the statutes, and it's discussed in the bill, he must at that point in time file with the Secretary of State or the County Court and perfect the lien that he has. Then the only really other change we have made is that we have put an effective date on of July 1, 1979, and we feel that's important because harvest normally starts the latter part of July and could affect some people if this happened again.
Sure. Yes, Dennis?
Is this a problem every year or is this a problem last year?
Well, it's a problem that has occurred twice that we know of. Another time in with the case of MICO, a cooperative in Dallas or Monmouth Independence area. It doesn't occur very often. We would hope that it would occur not very often, but the reason we put the July 1 on is because of the harvest situation.
Mike, is it contemplated that you follow the grain or the proceeds into the hands of any successor in interest with respect to the operation of the lien?
You follow it to the first buyer. In that case, it would be the co-op. The problem
well,
you
just
have
the first buyer, or
well,
I mean, who else is implicated if it turns out the bill doesn't get paid? Can you then trace it to the either the proceeds yeah. to the people
you can,
who bought the water?
Yeah,
the
you can go much further than that. There's no question about that.
And under this bill?
Yeah, I believe that's
and
the
where you could not go before.
Well, you. In some cases you could, but the filing never occurred. The farmers really have never used the Uniform Commercial Code. The distance was a problem for them in getting to the courthouse. They sell their grain at different times during the year. They might sell some bushels now when the price looks good. They might have forward contracted in another period. And this would basically provide that for a 90-day period, that they would not have to file. They would have to file after 90 days, though.
And I guess you haven't really made the case for me that the UCC is inadequate with respect to
well
remedies.
The farmer is not does not deal with the code. He does not, as the normal business person might.
Well, ranchers certainly do. I mean, we've had lots of concern with how this UCC operates on cattle sales, auctions, and so forth in the last three sessions.
Yeah, there is.
And we have accommodated those interests within the structure of the code.
Yes, they did amend the statutes to provide for certain filings and so forth. Most of the farmers do not know about it. They're not aware of it. The distance becomes a real problem for them in getting to the courthouse. They don't file. Historically, they haven't. In Union County, they didn't. And we felt that it would be much easier to provide that they would have an interest in the proceeds of the grain they sold for at least 90 days. And then if they wanted to continue and they had not been paid, they would then at that period in time, the bankers felt that that 90 days was long enough, and then after that period of time, they would be able to then file, and everyone would know who had a security interest and what.
You know, I'm not trying to hass you on this.
No,
you're trying to make a case for it, and I certainly don't think that there's any hidden agenda, which is an evil motive on the part of the wheat growers.
No, I understand exactly where you're coming from.
In 75, we cleaned up the lien laws, and I worked on the subcommittee that was in charge of that, and we spent weeks with the lien laws after the two-year study committee, the Law Improvement Committee, had really done the work in it and consolidating it, making it simple, cutting down the number of liens. And one of the trends that they identified that was a bad trend was increasing the number of occupations or businesses that's entitled to a lien law. So I suppose philosophically I have some concern about expanding it. Second point is, you know, the UCC's been around for at least a dozen years. If people aren't familiar with that, how in the hell are they going to be familiar with this one obscure law if it passes, which will be in the books and which might even have the potential of catching many more people in the air. And it seems to me that if that's a concern, you increase the risk by providing a special procedure that applies to grain.
Well, normally you're going to be paid within 90 days. That normally occurs. We felt that, and the bankers felt that after 90 days, it was then up to the producer to understand what was happening. But for at least the first 90 days, you're normally going to be paid in that period of time. Not that farmers are ignorant, they do not deal with this part of the code, the wheat producers don't, as a normal businessman might. And you're talking about his crop is on the line to a large extent. He's got a crop out there, and there are a lot of other variables that he's going to be thinking about rather than going down to the courthouse every time that he sells some bushels or a truckload or whatever of grain.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Have you run this by any of the UCC experts around? I have no personal reaction to the bill one way or the other, but it just seems to be an area where there's just all kinds of potential, and when you get into any type of proceeds, commercial code, anything like that, we get in a really technical area of the law, as technical as it can be, and it's not that I don't like your bill, it's just there's a gut reaction here that we may mess with the criminal law a little bit, but whenever you get into this, it's just...
Well, I don't know necessarily who the experts are. At one of our meeting, Frank Bronner, the representative for the Oregon Bankers Association, brought in attorneys who deal in this area from First National, U.S., and so forth.
Could I suggest one? There's a
man
at Lewis and Clark Law School, named Douglas Newell, N-E-W-E-L-L, who's probably the most knowledgeable man I've ever seen in any type of commercial law like this, and I would really appreciate if you...
If
Henry Bailey across the street helped write the code.
Who?
Henry J. Bailey.
Yeah, Henry J. Bailey right here, but...
is that Willamette?
If there's a problem, we would like to know about it, too. We had not anticipated any problems, but we would want to make sure that it is written correctly and it's not going to cause more problems than it runs an assault.
Any questions to the witness? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bugles.
there, I gather that you work with, since you worked with Bronner, and I see one of our friendly bankers looking at us back there, that there's no objection to the banking industry to the amended version, which is...
No, we have sat down a long time, various meetings, to get to this point.
Because you don't want to impair the negotiability of the, either the product or the documents covering it.
There was no question that the bill as originally written would have impaired that, and the financing would have been difficult to come by. So we wanted to ensure that we were not creating more problems, and we felt, and the attorneys for the various parties felt, that we had arrived at a workable solution. But we are amenable to any suggestions and to talking to people. There's no question about that.
Further questions?
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else to be heard on House Bill 2894? If not, close the public hearing on House Bill 2894.
At this time, we'll hold 2894 over via comments from experts in lien law. And
may I suggest that the proponent of the bill,
Mr. Dewey.
We're going to hold the bill until I receive word from you that you contacted those people. So it's now in your hands.
Okay, let's take up House Bill 2800. Dennis, after this point in time, would it be possible to have the bills that are heard in work session pulled and placed in individual files instead of just having the bill books? This is just, it's getting ridiculous.
Sure.
And, you know, we get rid of a lot of paperwork on the desk.
Yeah, the committee as a whole would like which bills before it on work session? Just
all the ones that are on the agenda.
Just for that day.
Right.
And there are times when you want to cross refer.
We can pull
mine. I use the individual filing system.
Me too.
So that mine do need pulling, and that would be a big help.
All of us from here bring our own.
The good guys over here.
The guys on the guys on the left.
Yeah. Pull the chairman's bill,
please.
And the vice chair.
Okay. Okay. The first bill we'll take up is House Bill 2800, in work session.
I think I previously indicated my concerns with the bill that was sort of a one-way street that I certainly won't support in its present form. I think it and the bill seeking to raise the undertaking to $10,000, maybe both sides of the same street to an extent, would support the two of them being put together.
Okay. I'm not really excited about either one of them for various reasons, but I think that if we're going to take some action as a committee, that it should be with one vehicle. Representative Rutherford?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's appropriate to award attorney's fees in these cases.
Well, that's
either. And I don't think the bond is appropriate.
Okay.
You're calling Mr. Nutt.
Sir, motion on House Bill 2800.
I'll move
to table. Representative Cohen moves House Bill 2800 be tabled. The motion is non-debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lombard?
First up, huh?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
No.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Bugis?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Perlmutter?
No.
Carter?
Aye. Passes. Okay, let's take up House Bill 2284.
Mr. Chairman, I move to table.
Representative Cohen moves that House Bill 2284 be tabled. The motion is non-debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
No.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Lombard?
No.
Thornmeyer?
No.
Cohen?
Aye.
Bugis?
No.
Gardner?
Aye, passes. Okay, we'll now take up House Bill 2560.
2284, what you said.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards?
I move to table House Bill 2560.
Representative Richards moves to table House Bill 2560. The motion is non-debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Hugis?
No.
Cohen?
Aye.
Grunmeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
She's over there.
Passes.
That's all we did with those two.
Where is Hugis? Nobody can find him. He's very much.
I like it better if you do that.
I want to say it
a little more freely.
Order of the committee. I just want to say that we've reached a new height of arbitrariness and thank the committee for it. Is there further business to come before the committee? Hearing none, adjourn.
When do we have a party?